Hit it.
Hello, this is Michael Vandervoort, and we have rolled into the second half of the year. I can't believe it. Hey, Phil, how you doing today?
Good, Michael. Good, Michael. Good to see you.
You too. Hey, we're going to do a quick show today, a quick episode of the Left the Boom show, and it's just you and I instead of us having a guest, and I thought it would be fun to start out with, since I get this question every time I try to book a guest who isn't in our space. They want to know why the Left the Boom show. So can you enlighten our listeners as to where Left the Boom came from and how you managed to write a book with that title?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Left the Boom show, of course, is from the book Left the Boom.
Yep.
And Left the Boom it's not my idea. So it came out of the conflict in Afghanistan and Iraq. And actually, I talk about it in the book, but the first time I had heard the term was in a conversation with a client. And the basic idea was that when we were fighting over in Afghanistan and Iraq, when we went in, the military sort of just like swept right into Iraq. And the soldiers were kind of in theater and became targeted by terrorists using improvised explosive devices. And long story short, there was this whole cat and mouse game that went on for several years where the terrorists would like come up with new ways to either place bombs or to detonate bombs, and the military would come up with countermeasures but they were really having no success at stopping these attacks. And they ended up bringing in a group that started treating these attacks like crime scene investigations. And they basically started going through every single time one of these devices went off, they would try to do everything they could to discover how it was built. Over time, they built this, they called it the MOAS, but the mother of all spreadsheets, to look at every single one of these different attacks and all the different data points that they could collect. And eventually what they were able to do was to start figuring out where these bombs were most likely being made. And that's the point where they really started to having an impact. But how Left the Boom enters into this is they called these attacks booms. So like every time a bomb went off, that was a boom. And then there's all these events that lead up to the boom. So you have to, first of all, you have to have someone who hates you enough that they want to, kill you with a bomb. And then you need to have somebody who can like accumulate the material to make a bomb. And then they have to have the expertise to make one. And turns out that if you're, once you figure out how to make one, that doesn't blow you up, you keep making them that same way. And so they kind of end up having fingerprints. So a bomb maker makes the bomb the same way every time, and so on. Well, all of those things they called Left of the Boom. So before the boom happened, all these things had to occur. And then everything that happened after one of these devices detonated, you might go chase down and try to figure out like who caused it. And then you obviously have all the aftermath after the boom, and that's right of boom. Yeah. So I looked at employee relations kind of the same way. I mean, I make clear in the book, I'm not calling, unions terrorists, and I'm not saying that, employee relations issues are, life or death like a bomb attack, but there are boom events in the lives of companies. Mm-hmm. And a union campaign would be like that, or getting sued could be like that, or, God forbid someone gets hurt at work. And there are events that lead up to that boom. And then there are things that happen after that boom. And the whole argument of the book is that employers, all your leverage is on the left side of boom, and you should be working hard to interdict all those different steps that would lead up to the boom event in the life of the company. And so that's where the book came from. And then, of course, that's what, we named the show after the book. But the whole idea of being Left of Boom as far as the show, is that we're encouraging companies to operate on that left side of boom, be proactive, be preventative, solve small problems before they become big problems, you know, create an extraordinary workplace where people don't feel the need to kind of go outside of the relationship with their boss or the relationship with their company, you know, solve problems together directly.
Right. Do the right thing, be an exceptional workplace or exceptional employer. And you'll never get to that point where there's a disaster that strikes your company, or hopefully you'll never get there anyway. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks for the explanation. Now I can refer people to this show and let them listen to it. So that'll be great. I kind of knew the backstory, but I thought that other folks might like to hear it from you. So, like as I mentioned at the top, this is we literally just passed the first half of the year is over. It's been a really busy year around here. It's been a really busy year in the world of labor relations, and so I thought we'd touch on a couple things, kind of to wrap up, you know, Q2, I guess. One of the first ones is the board has a couple of, well, President Biden nominated a couple of people to the board, renominated one and nominated Lauren McFerrin, the current chair, and he also nominated a Republican replacement. So you want to kind of talk to us a little bit about what's going on with that? Maybe the Josh Dietelberg, I don't really know him, don't know much about him other than everything I've read said he's like super smart labor attorney.
Yeah.
But right now it's the nominations happened, but there hasn't been much action. So where are we at on that? What do you foresee?
Yeah, I've met Josh. He's, you know, all of the reports are correct. He is wicked smart, and he'd be a terrific member of the board. And I think would, you know, all of the board members, if you ever, you know, hear them talk, they want to have a full complement of board members.
Yeah.
The board
yeah.
doesn't really work well when there's a seat open. Now, the president could have nominated that seat to be filled a lot sooner than he did. But in any event, he finally did nominate Josh, and he'd be a terrific add to the board. And then Lauren McFerrin, he renominated to be chair of the board. And so that happened. And then the steps now are... there are calls to have hearings at the Senate. They have to be confirmed by the Senate, and even McFerrin has to be reconfirmed. There's a lot of you know, hand wringing right now over whether she should be reconfirmed.
Right.
There's a lot of controversy about her being renominated, and then you know you have to. They typically do these votes as a package. And so that package deal, you know, they kind of would vote you know, the Democrats would be willing to let the Republican on if the Republicans are willing to let the Democrat on. So right. That's sort of where we're sitting right now. The chances are basically zero that either of these two will be confirmed prior to the presidential election. And then pending the outcome of the presidential election, that would then determine whether or not these two would be voted, and it could happen, you know, if Biden were reelected, then it could happen during like the lame duck session. If Trump were elected, there would be no way that they would put McFerrin back in, because the chair would end up being a Republican, and there would be a third Republican member,
right.
And so you would expect that President Trump would put in another Republican nominee in place of McFerrin. So, you know, I can't imagine that there will be any action here until after the election, and then who knows what happens in the election.
Yeah.
The whole episode in and of itself. But
anyway. Yes. And I think when the nominations were first rolled out, there was some pushback from the Republican side, I think, where they said that Biden was trying to get McFerrin reconfirmed because that would give her like a longer lasting term on the board. Mm-hmm. And you know, so, yeah, so they're yeah, like,
they're 5-year terms. So it literally makes no sense to renominate her reconfirm her until the election happens. Like there'd be no reason to do it, because she would be on for 5 years. And if you are if you're on the Republican side, you would assume that your hope anyway is that Trump wins the election, and then he's going to nominate a Republican for that seat, and he would not, at least as we're currently situated, he would not have a chance to renominate for that seat for 5 years. Now, one of the other Democrat seats would roll off before that 5 years was up. But yeah, why would you do that? There's no way.
Yeah. And then that kind of brings us to, like, I want to go to another person at the NLRB, but there's sort of this difference in status that has come out. So Jennifer Abruzzo, as the Biden administration, proved successfully with an unprecedented move when they fired the former GC Peter Robb that had been appointed by mm-hmm. Donald Trump, and then that was appealed and the right to fire Robb was upheld. So Jennifer Abruzzo, who's the current general counsel and has been a very aggressive general counsel trying to make a lot of changes, not really very beloved of the employer community, one might suppose that tit for tat in terms of the Biden response, that if Trump was elected, that he may come in and try to fire Abruzzo on day one, as Biden did with GC Robb. And you can do that according to the courts. However, with McFerrin, it doesn't work the same way. Can you kind of walk us through the differences?
Yeah, and I'm a little contrarian on this, but I'm not as convinced that day one of a Trump administration, Abruzzo gets fired. Now, I know
right.
there will be a lot of people asking for that. And I think a lot of people just sort of assume like that would happen. I mean, it mm-hmm. happened the first day of the Biden administration. But I like to point out to people that, you know, we've already had a Trump administration once, and labor issues are just not a big deal in the whole scheme of the things that Trump cares about and that administration cared about. Labor was way, way down on the list. It took them a long time to even get the board seats filled. And labor just like wasn't a huge priority. And you also have to remember, you know, Trump has a lot of union support. I mean, Sean O'Brien is speaking at the Republican.
Right.
And that, I mean, that is basically at the invitation of Trump. So he doesn't have the sort of same fire in the belly for, you know, against labor that Biden has in favor of labor. So I would not just assume on day one that Abruzzo is fired. She could be, the legal authority is now that she can be. So it could happen. And it, you know, that would be upheld if Trump were to do that. I'm just not convinced that that's going to be at the top of their list of stuff to do on day one.
I suspect that there's a much longer list of priorities aimed in other directions than the NLRB
right.
for day one right. anyway.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it'll be, yeah, there'll be a lot, you know, there's a lot of stuff that will happen. So that's that. But McFerrin, on the other hand, the board seats, at least as we sit here today, this, by the way, is subject of you know, constitutional litigation, but the board seats, they are for 5-year terms, and the president cannot remove a board member during that term. They're not serving at the pleasure of the president like the general counsel is. So because of that, you know, McFerrin would serve out her entire term if she were to be reconfirmed, you know, before, you know, the end of the year. She would be in that seat for, you know, for 5 years. So now that's one of the reasons that there's, you know, the argument in SpaceX and other cases that are saying that that is one of the things that makes the way the board is set up unconstitutional, you know, because they don't serve at the pleasure of the president. And so it's an unconstitutional delegation of executive authority to do that. Mm-hmm. But that hasn't been ruled on yet with the board. It's in front of the Fifth Circuit at least the SpaceX case. There's a number of other cases where that is an issue. So we'll see how that turns out.
Before we jump to what I had last on the agenda, this has been a busy week. Chevron and a bunch of other decisions.
Yeah,
Yeah, Jarchese. Yeah, I know you didn't. I didn't ask you to prep for this, but you wrote some stuff about it. How much turmoil is this all going to cause? A lot? A little? Are we going to have litigation backing up in the courts? What's your quick take on that at a high level?
It's, long term, it certainly increases the chances that there will be litigation. It increases the, those cases so far aren't labor cases. So and Chevron, the court said, we're not going backwards. This is just prospective. So basically what happens now is that the Chevron doctrine, which is basically that you have to defer to the agencies. Courts don't really have to defer to the agencies anymore, their interpretations of their statutes. And so that means when you challenge some of their interpretations, the court gets to make its own decision. Now, they could still agree with the agency's decision. They just don't have to defer if they disagree. So on the margin, you would expect there's going to be probably more agency decisions that will be overturned than would have been under Chevron. But I don't think it's like some giant watershed. I do think over time, what's going to happen is you'll see probably more like regulations. So like there's the overtime rule. OSHA just issued a rule on heat standards, the walk around rule. There's a lot of these different rulemakings that are happening that I could imagine courts going like, look, this is way beyond what the statute says. You don't have the authority to do this. And then that gets overruled. I think you're going to see some of that happen. And people will certainly, there's another like big case that came down yesterday that is like this little sort of seems like a minor issue, but it's actually massive. And that is they ruled that on the statutory claims, like there's a 6-year statute of limitations. So like once the regulation goes into place, there's 6 years during which you can like bring a complaint about it. But then after that, it sort of closes off being able to like dispute the regulation. Well, the Supreme Court ruled yesterday that actually the 6 years starts at the point that you've been injured. And so the injuries can be ongoing, right? You can go like, well, this regulation, even though it's been on the books for 25 years, you enforced it against me yesterday. So I have 6 years from yesterday to file my claim. That's a big deal because that means that a lot of regulations are now sort of at risk to litigation, and then now the courts don't have to defer. So that's probably even, as big as Chevron is, that's those two combined is a very big deal. I think you are going to see a lot more litigation. I think you're going to see a rollback of some administrative interpretations. I don't think it's like as bad as unions and folks in favor of the agencies. I don't think it's as bad as they say it is, but it is a big deal.
Yeah, it seems like it's a big shift away from like the traditional agency solutions and stuff, mm-hmm. that Democrats have relied on so long to push policy.
Yeah, it's been a good week for the executive. Let's just say that. So like the immunity case, the executive power over administrative, over the administrative power. But the Chevron case, the Chevron case is a little bit of a knockback of executive power because it lets the courts sort of intervene against the administration.
Yeah. And it's interesting. All this stuff touches on labor, but the impact isn't direct like a lot of the NLRB cases and stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't really know what the eventual outcomes will be, but it's definitely going to be a shift.
The Jarchese case is an SEC case. It's the same issue. That same issue is in play at other places. I was a little disappointed. The Supreme Court, they had in front of them, because that was a Fifth Circuit case, and the Fifth Circuit ruled that the way that the ALJs were put in place is also unconstitutional. The court never ruled on that. So that's the law in the Fifth Circuit right now, But the court didn't rule on that. They only ruled on the Seventh Amendment claim. So that's an argument that's also in front of the Fifth Circuit for the on the NLRB in that SpaceX case. So we'll probably get a ruling that I would expect to be very similar, that the ALJs at the NLRB are also unconstitutionally put into place. So, you know, we'll see. But the Supreme Court didn't rule on that. So that's, you know, to be determined.
Yeah, we've also got like overtime rules and applicable new overtime rules everywhere for exemptions and stuff, except Texas and whatnot. So it's definitely an interesting time. We'll be deciding stuff like down the block. How do we feel about it in Broken Arrow versus Tulsa pretty soon? But anyway, to wrap up, last thing you did, I've seen you do a couple updates internally here recently, and you were sharing some data. And by the way, I wanted to mention that our second quarter summary, our petitions and elections, that report will be coming out a little bit later this afternoon, which is July 2nd, July 3rd. I've lost track of my dates. July 2nd.
Yeah.
So that there will be a link for that at some point in the show notes. But there's a lot of activity, petitions, elections and stuff. So I think you said in the last update I saw, I believe you said that activity's up 30% year over year.
Mm-hmm.
So want to talk about that a little bit, where we're at, where we're headed maybe into the new year.
Right. Well, the headline you'll probably get is 12%. So RC petitions are up 12%. But after the CEMEX case last year, there's been, I think for so far, the first half of the year has been like 250 RM petitions filed. Mm-hmm. Almost all of those are certification cases. So in other words, once the union makes a demand for recognition, they can file an RC, but if they don't, the employer has to file an RM. And so that's happened 250 times just in the first part of this year. So when you add up those cases, the number's 30%. So it's a 30% increase year over year of certification events is how I would call that. It's going to be very confusing. So like you're going to hear crazy stats, our report's coming out this week, but Bloomberg will have one. The board themselves come out every quarter with sort of an announcement of statistics, and it'll be interesting to see. I don't know how everyone else is handling it, but we report out both the RCs and the RMs because now the RMs are basically RCs.
Mm-hmm. The question came up in one of the meetings we were in about like some of the RCs and RMs are kind of like duplicates. The union files and the employer mm-hmm. files, and then one may pull a petition. So it's a little bit hard to kind of completely track where that's at, right? Yeah. So the numbers look a little different depending on how you count them and report them. And I think you made a comment that you said you wish they would figure out some way to kind of reconcile that. What could they do there?
Well, they are going to know more than any, like the way that we've at least attempt to figure that out is, you look at two petitions that are for the same employer in the same location and the same unit, and you sort of like tie all those two together and you go, okay, those must be the same location, right? But you do that like by the address and by, the unit description and things like that. Well, the employer or the union, it's not uncommon that like they define the unit differently or the address is a little bit different or, so you can't, a lot of these you can't know absolutely for sure. But the board does know for sure, are these two the same employer? Like, am I talking to the same lawyer and same union about the same location? Like, the board knows that. So you would hope that at some point they would figure out a way to kind of like tie those two together. Now, they don't care that, right? Mm. I mean, for them, the amount of activity, like double reporting petitions is good for them because they go, oh, we need more money. Because
we're so activity, busy.
Yeah. So I don't imagine that they would do that, but it would be for those numbers to really be accurate. It would be a lot better if they had some way to either have like the same docket number or, like RM kind of is, it's always historically been a desert. And so it's, you know, now it's not. And so now they're basically RCs. So I kind of feel like another approach would just be like, there's just RCs. And like you, like if the employer files an RC, you know, it would then be like the same case. So I think, I don't know, but that's not how they're doing it. So they're doing it with an RM. And so now is this issue of duplicates. We're trying to kind of identify those and, you know, not count them, you know, when we can, but, it's hard to do.
Yeah. And especially like when a union files, like we've seen going back a bit, but we've seen like Starbucks where there's different addresses, even though it's probably the same store, but they use like a different street address or describe it differently or whatever. It is really confusing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So to wrap up, because once we're done with this, I'm headed to vacation for a few days. So I don't want too much to stand between me and the door. No, no, but
we offer vacations. That's crazy.
What? Who does that? Yeah. No PTO, but yeah,
that's how we have to do that. That's how we do an extraordinary workplace. You got
X, right. We get a day off twice a year. No, all joking. But seriously, to wrap up. So the election's coming up, and I don't get all political, but this last half of the year is going to be filled with all kinds of volatility and all kinds of uncertainty. And that's an environment that for employers, not even tied to politics, just in general, the uncertainty of people, for employers, if their workers don't know what things are going to be like, you know, the Biden administration leaves, their support for union leaves, just like prognosticate as best you can, realizing you're looking into a very dim and murky crystal ball here. Where are we headed, like, once the dust settles? I mean, I know it depends on who wins the election in large part, but let's just say Trump wins. Does that aggravate unions and raise their activism? Or does the change in the government philosophy that will occur settle things down a little bit? Or is it just impossible to tell?
I think it's very possible to tell. If Trump wins, it will be like more chaos, just like it was the last time he was in. Now I'm not, you know, there was, unions are going to be, very upset. They're going to, you know, they will rail against, you know, anything that, you know, that they believe that the administration is doing to hurt them in any way. I'll go back to what I said at the beginning, which is that, you know, Trump is not, I mean, this is really just, this isn't just Trump. Like when the Republican Party comes into power, on the labor side, they're just not as energetic as the Democrats are. Like the Democrats, when they land on day one, like they already know what they're doing for like the next 4 years. And that's really not as true on the Republican side. So I think in that sense, you know, you will see unions are going to be, you know, they're going to be upset. Their guy will have lost. They like Joe Biden is without question the most pro-union president that we've ever had. They're going to lose that. All of the agencies will, you know, will flip over. There's been a lot, you know, a lot made from Trump himself and from his folks about sort of, you know, dismantling the administrative state. And if they really follow through on some of the stuff that they're talking about, then you could certainly imagine, like, you know, funding at the NLRB getting gutted. I mean, the House just proposed, I forget, like a $200 million pay cut to the board. So if anything close to that, you know, were to go into place, that would be a massive, massive change. Unions would be very upset. So, you know, you can certainly see like possibilities of all of that stuff happening. I think, you know, Trump has a lot of union support. I don't think he's going to be nearly as aggressive against unions as like Biden was for. I also just don't think he cares that much about, you know, labor issues. And so you know, I think in that sense, probably as far as the labor world itself is concerned, I think, you know, you'll get a Republican majority board. There'll be a lot of rollback of the, you know, the decisions that came out during the Biden administration. So all of that stuff will happen. But I think the bigger picture is going to be like sort of what other, you know, chaos is happening. And that could, I mean, look, like, that probably sounds like I'm saying that's horrible. Like there were winners and losers in the chaos the last time. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, mm-hmm. you know, but Trump is clearly way more aggressive on trade, way more aggressive on immigration. So like, there's a lot of other things that impact employers, you know, besides
right.
the labor laws that will, I believe like Trump will be way, way more aggressive about, and that will be the kinds of stuff. It'll be those areas where he is going to be like active on day one. And so I think from an employer community standpoint, like that is really the area of most focus, not as much the sort of labor policy side.
But it probably doesn't, I would guess, at least in the short term post the election, it probably doesn't quell or backtrack on the trend of more elections, more petitions. People, I think that's going to continue for a while.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Unions don't become less popular because Trump gets elected. Unions don't organize less because Trump gets elected. All of that, I think, continues apace. I think that you're, and to some extent maybe accelerates, right? There will be, you know, a lot of anger about the, you know, the results of that election on the left and sort of, you know, union activity and strike activity and like a general strike. And I can imagine a lot of that sort of stuff happening as like a response to, you know, Trump being elected. So I don't think it slows unions down at all.
Right. Well, that brings us to the end of the end of another edition of the Left the Boom show. And if you listen to this show, now you know how it got its name. So have a good upcoming holiday weekend.